Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about Blade Runner 2049. Now I know what you're thinking, we've done it before, but we haven't, not like this, because today we have some very special guests. When you watch the film and you saw all that amazing tech on screen, all the UI stuff, the user interface stuff, wherever Kay or any of the characters are interacting with tech on screen, that tech was made by Territory Studio. And we're joined by two of the people from Territory Studio who made all that beautiful hardware that you see the characters using in Blade Runner 2049. And they are Peter Essegni and Andrew Popplestone. And joining me here in the Cosmic Shed are
Maddie
and Steve.
Now, Andrew, you've said in interviews before that you have to create a new kind of tech. So tell me, what does that take?
As you know from watching the film, we're in an alternate universe, essentially. There was a cataclysmic event that changed technology as we know it. You know, when we first spoke to Denis, he said, okay, we're in a world that doesn't have digital technology. We've got a wholly different kind of technology. What is it? How does it work? How do we interact with it? What does it look like? And that's ultimately the challenge we face when we say we had to conceive a new kind of technology.
Okay. Well, before we go any further, amazing job. I mean, seriously, it's wonderful. I think, even those people who haven't loved the film have said it looks amazing and it transports you to a world. And as you are fully aware, I'm sure, your role in that is key.
Thank you. It does look incredible. I'd say we had a very small part in it, but the film is absolutely stunning. No one can deny that. It's what Denis and Roger Deakins did is just beautiful.
You just said when you first spoke to Denis, I don't know about everybody else listening, but certainly I got very excited at that point. So tell us about that conversation. How does that happen? And what did he say?
Well, first of all, we pinched ourselves. And then we jumped on a plane over to Budapest. So Peter, myself, and Jen, our producer, we flew over and we were told we were going to meet Paul Inglis, who is the supervising art director, and I think potentially Dennis Gassner, the production designer as well. And we were going to get a brief on the work. We had a very rough understanding of the kind of things we might be asked to look at, but not really. But so we kind of threw a few ideas down, some rough reference imagery. And so we weren't completely unprepared. However, we were kind of ushered into this large room with this long table and a television at the end. And more people kind of started to walk in. Paul comes in, Dennis comes in, all the visual effects guys come in, all the producers come in, and then suddenly Denis walks in as well.
He was there first. That was the surprising thing, because you sort of like thought about that might sort of like come in with a large entourage or something like that. We've certainly seen those kind of appearances before, not from him. And then he came in totally sort of like unannounced and just walked in and sat down and we started to talk. And that's when all the other guys came in. So it was really like we were thrown in at the deep end.
You're fully versed in his way of doing films already, right? When you spoke to him.
We haven't
worked with him before.
That was the first time we were lucky enough to work with him. But we really hope certainly that wasn't the last.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not. But how did he come to know you then?
It was Paul Inglis, who was the supervising art director on Blade Runner. We worked with him previously on Prometheus, and he recommended us because that was one of the first big breaks of Territory that we worked on Prometheus. And when Paul was in the position of being able to recommend companies that could do this sort of design related task, he recommended us. And then obviously he was very convincing and we got the gig.
the story goes that David, the founder of Territory, he heard that Paul was working on a certain film, called him up and said, "Paul, I hear you may be working on a certain film. If you are working on said film, I would give my right arm to get Territory on said film." And lo and behold, we got asked to bid, and we got it, and we were on.
Okay.
Before we knew it, we were in Budapest.
Yeah. Okay, so Prometheus, Ex Machina, The Martian, Blade Runner 2049.
Something rings a bell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Pretty good, huh?
Not bad.
And you're still so humble as well. Yeah, we kind of did this thing.
We might sound humble, but we're just floating in our huge pool in the office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, it looks like Club Tropicana.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So martinis right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
I, as everyone's already said, was really, really blown away by the whole visuals of the film. Well, the whole film, it's put together so well, and there's so many really impressive and exciting aspects to it. But your part does really interest me. Can you tell us a little bit about the process that you go for? Where do you come in with the film? You said you went to Budapest, but are there actors on set and they're acting with blank screens, or are you way before that and then the visuals are done by the time the actors get there?
What we do usually, this is how we started out. We started out doing on-set graphics. Which means we sit down with the director, sit down with the production designer, and we come up with ideas, visual sort of like thoughts about how this technology could work and what it means, how it works in this world. And then we deliver this before the actual shoot starts. And then hopefully everything is going well, and then everybody on set is able to use those screens and act with them and act against them. And I think I'm pretty sure Andrew will say a few words about how it was on Blade Runner.
I guess one of the extra benefits of on-set graphics as well is that it gives actors something to work with. Some films go down the post route and just compositing graphics in afterwards, which is, you know, super easy and blah blah blah. But it never gives you the same effect. I mean, we do a bunch of that as well, but it's always so much more. There's just an element of realism on when you have on-set graphics, because one, like I say, the actors have got something to work with, but then you also get the real kind of interactive lighting, which was one of the things that Roger Deakin really wanted. You know, he is a master at it, and he used our screens to create this beautiful interactive lighting with the actors.
How prescriptive is Denis, and is it sort of, we want this, go and watch the film, the original, and make something out of it, or is it...
It was quite important that one of the things that Denis said quite early on, that we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't base our ideas on the first film. It's not a linear continuation of the first film, because of there was this big thing that happened between the first film and the second film. So that was a very clever way of creating sort of like a blank slate to start the ideas from. I don't really think that Denis was too sort of like strict. He just said...
Do you know what? The coolest thing about him was that he just tried to give us a grounding, yeah, of his world, his universe. He was like, hey, this thing's happened. We're in a whole new world now in terms of technology and the way people use technology. Mm-hmm. And go away and conceive it. And we spent a couple of weeks just playing and coming up with various weird and wonderful ways. You know, how might this technology work in terms of, okay, if it's not digitally based, what is it? Is it more physical? Is it some sort of chemical reaction? Is it a cross between the two? And then we tried to work out ways of bringing that to life. And we came up with a bunch of things, some of which Denis really, really loved, some which he hated. And if you've heard any interviews with him, you'll see why, see what I mean, because he's such a passionate guy and he just absolutely knows what he likes and what he doesn't. And so it was so refreshing to work with him. And he just, anything that was abstract or physical or organic, he wanted us to develop. So in terms of being really prescriptive, no, he was quite broad. But once we started to produce stuff, he was amazing at driving us down the direction that he wanted to go.
He was really good at giving feedback. And I think, you could really tell whether he loved something or not, because I'm pretty sure I've heard it from Ryan Gosling on one of his interviews, that whenever he heard the three deeply, deeply, deeply love it, he was absolutely sure that Denny really liked his performance. And I can definitely confirm that whenever Denny said that I really deeply, deeply, deeply love this screen, he always sort of like, he was really happy to see those. And there were some ideas that he rejected. We obviously had a few sort of like ideas that did not go down well, and he wanted to do something different. But this is the best way of working, when someone gives you clear direction rather than, how about a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and why don't you try this and that? It was like, I love these ideas. This is a good direction. And I don't like this idea. Don't go down that way.
Can you tell us anything that he didn't like that you did?
There's this Russian illustrator. And she was working on the Russian space program back in the day. And she got a book which sort of like contained illustrations of the Russian space systems, all the Russian spaceships and the space stations and that kind of thing. And I really thought that something that graphic, something that illustrative could go down well. But he did not really love those. So that was absolutely fine, because we had better ideas. And I think, working in a team, everyone says that, but it was really, really important that everyone had a chance to put their ideas in front of Denis. And whenever he loved something, we really felt that's a big achievement on everybody's sort of like, everybody contributed to that idea. It wasn't just like,
He was really specific in that he hated anything that was too high tech, too slick. As you've seen, it's all quite gnarly and grungy and physical. If it looked like it could exist in a Marvel universe, that no chance, absolutely no chance. That was a firm no. And likewise, he wanted something that had never been seen before. He was like, I want something completely original. How possible that is, I don't know, but that was the challenge that we had to try and achieve,
Obviously you pulled it off. It's amazing. I want to know how you did it, but first I'm really looking forward to seeing that Russian design in something else that you
work on. It's up the sleeve. It's up the sleeve for the next one.
Fantastic. How did you go about it?
We've got a really collaborative team here. And often what happens is, we all sit down and we hash out these ideas and these rough themes and concepts. And often what happens is everyone goes off, comes back, and some things land, some things don't. And generally the guys just split up and end up going down certain routes. So, Peter did a whole bunch of stuff for the morgue and LAPD. A couple of the other artists were concentrating more on the Wallace stuff. And it was a whole bunch of experimentation in terms of how we got there. I mean, as you know, as I'm sure you saw, the Wallace stuff is very, very different. It's super high end. It's very slick and minimal and cold, black and white. It's reflective of Wallace himself.
Which was really, really funny, because we didn't know that he's going to be blind.
Yeah.
But the complete lack of colour ties into that kind of thing. I don't know whether that was...
But, so the guys went off and they started doing a whole bunch of weird, wonderful experimentation stuff, especially when we're trying to look at sort of organic, abstract-type techniques. Guys started photographing fruit at a macro level to get wonderful textures that overlay. And Peter did some fantastic photogrammetry tests, which actually became the structure for the baseline scanner, which is in Josh's office.
Yeah, the fruit stuff is ingenious. Were there any fruits that you tried which just looked really, just didn't make it in at all. Or was it just like, oh, we're going to go for the grapefruit. That's our
it's funny you say that because that was the hero fruit.
Yeah, grapefruit was really, really well received. And because, you know, that's quite sort of like a spherical object and it was really cool. I think we experimented with, I think Nick did some tests on banana and that looked really, really cool. I think, yeah, but that was that looked cool in its own way. I think I tried, it's not a fruit, but I tried raw salmon. That did not look really good. We did try apples and pears and everything in between. But I think, you know, I think grapefruit was one of the things that work really well.
But it's one of those things, you know, CGI we do day in, day out, and, you know, we're reasonably good at it, and CGI is amazing. But when you're tasked with a brief like this, especially with a director who's encouraging us to experiment and do something different and unique, there's nothing like doing something for real, you know, whether you're creating something and then scanning it and printing it and then you know, working over the top of that and then scan it back in and layering that stuff up or photographing stuff and then projecting that onto an object or using photogrammetry, all these kind of techniques that have a human element or create imperfections were where the great stuff was, when the great stuff happened. You know, that's everything that we did in terms of unusual techniques often turned out the best.
The baseline test, What did they tell you about that before you started working on it?
I guess it was, the analogy was that it's kind of a modern version of the Voigtkamp. It's what they're using now to work out whether the, obviously in the old one, it's to work out whether a subject was a replicant or not. Whereas in 2049, it was to work out whether Kay was, had gone off the rails or whether he was, you know, still in control. But that was kind of like the rough essence of what it was for. It was to gauge his brain and whether he'd gone doodally, really.
Is he too excited?
Yeah,
that was the whole thing. I mean, like, when
he got too excited, obviously his baseline was very different compared to what it was before. And I think the main difference is the Voigtkamp did it on a surface level. It was about the eyes and all sorts of, it was like a lie detector, if you will. And this one was more on a cellular level, but it's not necessarily invasive. So they invented this technique. I don't really know how it worked, but yeah, we made it up.
I mean, all we were told was that, you know, Kay would come back off his missions and he'd sit in this little room and he'd have a camera pointed at him, which is essentially monitoring him and scanning his brain as he was repeating his answers. And it had to go through various levels. So it would constantly go deeper and deeper at a cellular level into his brain. And so, you know, how the hell did we visualize that in a way which wasn't digital? You know, you can't do a zoom. You can't just zoom in here and there because that's, you know, that's not the technology that we have anymore. So we started to play with this kind of lens shifting idea.
I think this whole lens based stuff was quite important in the film. And I just remembered recently I had a talk about how we did work on this film. And before I did that, it just occurred to me that when I was a kid, I went to the opticians. And back in the day, they really did these mechanical tests when they had this frame in front of your eyes and they just shifted those lenses over. They still do that? Really? I remember some more digital stuff than that. And then it just occurred to me that probably I went too much to the opticians when I was a kid. So that's where the whole idea comes from. Because I think that's a fascinating thing. That's something just happens in front of your eyes, these lenses shifting, and then you see something more clearly than before. I think that's really...
We use the same thing in the morgue as well, you know, this idea that these physical lenses shift into place. as you're going deeper and deeper into where he's analysing the bone, actually, in the morgue scene.
The market, you worked on the marketplace as well, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because that looks very different. That's much more colourful.
It is.
It and some of it's quite sort of...
it's quite gaudy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also this sort of, pixelated, handheld Space Invaders.
Kind of retro.
Yeah. Futuristic retro.
Paul had a very cool and very capable and talented design and graphic department on set. And they created quite a few of those graphics. So some of the market graphics came from them as stills. And we had to animate those and come up with similar concepts or something that takes that idea a little bit further. And I think that was really cool to see these kind of up close. You know, I don't know how much of it comes through the film, but quite a few of those were about like worms and food. And
so there were vending machines. There were two kinds of graphics in the market, really. And it was interesting, the market, because it was very different to the rest of the work that we did. Most of the rest of the work, if you're looking at the baseline or morgue scenes or stuff that happened in Wallace or in the limo, it was all very story driven. There was a narrative point that we had to convey, whether it was part of the plot or whether something happened, like the limo crashed and, you know, they were being attacked, blah, blah, blah. There was always kind of a story beat to it. Whereas in the market, it was more about adding
texture,
exactly, like conceptual texture to the universe, you know, how the people there live, you know, the fact that it's this, you know, pretty bleak dystopian world, and the only food that people have, the only protein that people can get, comes from worm farms. And so, you know, these vending machines that people go and get their, you know, pretty crappy food from was, you know, chicken nuggets made from worm protein, you know, it's that kind of weird stuff. Yeah. And you know, there's small details, but it all adds up. And then some of the other stuff as well were these LED banners that we made a bunch of those from as well. And again, that was all kind of weather and you know, again, to give you more of a sense of what's going on in the world.
I think it was more, it was, the vending machines were about food and sex toys. And I'm not joking here. There was a section dedicated to sex toys, which, well, that's in the film. I don't know how much of it comes through. But that came from the art department. But, you know, but we figured out that it ties into the story of BB's bar. I don't know how much of that came through the film, but I read the making of book. And BB's bar wasn't a sort of like a brothel, as I suspected, but it was more like a place where people just go and have fun. So that ties into that kind of like, I'm going to go to the market and grab a sandwich and then a sex toy and just go in there. So that's how bleak the Blade Runner world is.
Yeah. I mean, so when did you first see the full film?
When we saw it in the cinema.
And what, when you, I mean, I know when you looked at your bits, you're like, yeah, that worked. That's amazing. We did a wonderful job. You don't have to tell us that you did that. But what else did you see and you were just like, wow, they've done that beautifully? Or, you know, so, what blew your mind with the film?
Some of the shots were just so stunningly incredible, but I thought the Joy holograms were really cool. I thought they nailed those.
I think the cityscapes were absolutely fantastic, and the that last scene with the water and that whole kind of thing, that was smashing. And the trash mesa, I think that would look really good. Everything, basically.
I mean, because we obviously, when we were in we went to Budapest a couple of times, and we got to poke around the art department. We saw a whole bunch of concept art. We were in Dennis Gassner's office for a couple of hours, which was really great, because all the concept work was all plastered all over the walls, and it really gave us a sense, actually, of tonally what the world kind of looked like, and that really helps to get your head into it. And so, you know, we've seen a whole bunch of this concept art, and we'd read the script in a secure room, and but, you know, so we had rough ideas in our head, but it's still pretty loose. So to see those shots, like Peter says, you know, the cityscapes and those grand, beautiful vistas and those lingering shots, it was, I don't know, for me it was really, really moving actually.
Absolutely, it was like that. And actually, I think the only thing that we've seen before the film came out was a test shot that was sent back quite early on, because I think Roger Deakins did a screen test in Josh's office, because that was one of the first sets, and he sent back a video that showed us how it looks, and you know, is it too blue or is it too green? Should we change the colors a bit? Which was smashing, because then we felt that this is going to be really, really an integral part of this whole world. And it's not just going to be, because on some films, when we do these kind of jobs, it's just there and then it gets replaced in post, or a part of it gets replaced in post or gets amended or whatever. But this one, I would say that, you know, 90% of what we did on set was in the film, which is an absolutely sort of like, you know, that we don't really hear about this too often, do we?
The more that I watch the film, the more I see the number of layers of detail that go into the visuals. Every time I watch it, I see something new. What to you in your work in the film are you particularly proud of, or are there any little details that you want to comment on that you'd like people to spot next time they watch it?
I don't really know. I mean, like, you know, I like everything. I think, you know, what we did on this was really, really special for us, and really hope that the audience and you guys, I'm really sort of like grateful that you liked it. There's so much things in there that probably doesn't come through because of, you know, it's a film and it's just a very small part of the whole story. I don't know. What do you think, Andrew?
What I'm most proud of is
the market.
Absolutely, particularly the sex work ones. I think what I'm most proud of is what we created fit so seamlessly into the film. Mm. You know, it's not one of those cases like you know, a spy film or a Marvel film where there's 100 screens in the background and it's just there's just stuff everywhere. And it's plastered all over the place just to look high tech and cool, you know. The way that Denis used technology and the screens and the UI and everything was so considered. It was very minimal, and oddly enough, that actually made it that much more impactful. And it didn't, you know, what we did didn't leap out, didn't stand out. But it just helped. It just complemented what he did. It just fit in nicely. Mm. And that's what I'm most pleased about. You know, ultimately we're just here to help filmmakers and directors tell their story. And I think that's one of the most successful times that we've done that.
Awesome.
I think one of the stuff that's probably gonna be featured more in if there's gonna be an extended cut or you know, a DVD release. I, as soon as I said it, I knew. I don't know anything about that. I've never heard anything about that.
He just knows everything.
please, just don't misunderstand. That must be my accent. Sorry. So I think the neighbor's apartment. I think I really love that kind of thing, because we did like 18, 15, 16 little screens there, and that's the one where Kay scans the little wooden horse. And we did so many screens in there, and all of them were very quirky and wild and interesting and super, super, you know, it's fun.
Yeah. And cobbled together, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
And that was a fun one.
That's going to be the one that probably is going to have a few more details to be seen again.
Yeah. I guess what was fun about some of those screens, actually, looking back at those, was that a lot of those screens were kind of news reports from off-world and maps from off-world, and there were planets and, you know, things that...
Spaceship schedules.
Absolutely, spaceship schedules, yeah. Which, you know, as nerds that we kind of love to kind of geek out on that stuff.
You mentioned the way that it fits in with the world. It's the little touches that really struck me on the second view. The fact that it fits in with that sort of futuristic dystopic analog world where you've got screens that have burn in on them, and there's some sort of double imaging and ghosting stuff, all the sort of post-processing that you must have done after the initial design. The UI design, though, I know that in our world, UI design is a long and complicated and tricky thing. What sort of process did you go through in terms of designing the actual interfaces that we see people interacting with?
I think it was. I think, you know, it needed to be especially the non Wallace ones, because, you know, as Andrew said, Wallace core stuff that was designed. He had enough money and resources to employ designers to create the screens that he uses in the library and other places. But all the other stuff, the LAPD stuff, that was manufactured but just barely holds together. That just sort of like operates on a very basic level.
It's old tech at the time, isn't it? Even though it's kind of future tech for us, at the time, 2049, it's pretty dilapidated and old at that point. Whereas, as Peter says, Wallace, by contrast, is absolutely state of the art. It's so considered and deliberate and cold in its nature.
I think one of the things that we added as a little extra touch, I don't remember whether that's in the film or not, but in the first film, I think one of the things that I remember from the UI, and this is probably the only relation or only connection back to the original one, is the text writes from left to right to right to left that alternates, and I think we kept that on some of the Joshi stuff.
Yeah, all the spinner stuff, yeah. All the Joshi stuff. Or the LAPD, yeah. But in terms of UI design, you know, that comes from, you know, the designers understanding the story and the particular point of that scene. And so, the way we go about it is not just creating, you know, a concept on how this technology works and what it looks like, but what is that graphic language? And not only that, you know, what does how does that language work in a sense of, okay, well, okay, there's a file structure. How does that file structure work? How does that database work? How does it animate from one screen to the next? What happens if you minimize this? And how do you show a warning sign? Blah, blah, blah. That's all part of this overall graphic language, almost like a brand for each one. So we'd have a brand for LAPD, we'd have a brand for Wallace, and then build out multiple iterations from there.
I mean, how deep does that go? I mean, how much of that is there?
I think it's quite a lot. I mean, like, you know, that was, we had the luxury on this film to sort of like think quite a lot about how this works and how it trickles down, and where when we start to work on these kind of projects, and especially when we did work on this one, as Andrew said, the first 2 weeks were more about thinking about the ideas and experimenting with different things. You know, there's a very very important thread throughout the film, which is everybody who's left on Earth is pretty much a part of a sort of like an under, you know, that class system. That's an underclass, and you need to understand that immediately when you look at the technology as well. I think anything that's too colorful, too designed, too iPhone-esque would stand out, and you would immediately feel that this is not right. But when you see that the technology is sort of like, yeah, it does what it needs to do, but it doesn't go anywhere further than that. It's not pretty. It's not there to look nice or to entertain.
It's purely functional.
It's absolutely functional. Yeah. And these sort of little thoughts that we did put into this process are really, really important, and we are really proud of those.
Though oddly enough, we actually find the stuff that looks quite imperfect and broken quite beautiful.
Yeah,
but that's
yeah.
Just
totally. It just keeps the thing that always goes through my head with these things is Star Wars versus the prequels versus the new ones, and if it's done properly, it makes such a big difference. And also, to a lesser extent, something like Minority Report, which just dates so quickly. Because everything's so, you know, some parts of it date so quickly. I love it, but, you know, parts of it date so quickly the way it looks. he doesn't look futuristic anymore.
Yeah, I think Star Wars is a special case because that has its own universe and all the language that needs to be done on that film. Yeah, absolutely, very, very strong legacy, and we can't really talk about it, can we? But I'm pretty sure it's in really good hands, and it's you know it's a great sort of like universe, right? Okay. But I think you know Blade Runner gives us definitely or gave us more opportunity to explore it further than you know a Star Wars film could ever.
But that was part of the joy of Denis' brief and the way he asked us to go about it, and just him as a filmmaker, he allowed us to create something which was, dare I say, you know, more timeless, rather than you know, cut and paste Marvel film, which you know, as fun as they are, they all you know they all look the same. They all look cool. But, you know, all that technology and all that UI all looks the same.
I think everyone who worked on this film, and as Andrew said, we were just a very small part of it, and there was a really hard work for a lot of people. But I really felt that when we were on set, that everyone feels that kind of like, this is something special. And I did not really feel the... Yeah, this is another film that I have to work on, and then next week I'm going to work on another film, and you know, it's just a job kind of like feeling, and I think everyone felt that this is important in a way that, you know, they really wanted to go the extra mile.
Yeah, their A game, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Yeah, it reminds me of, as well, when we spoke to Andy Weir back in the day before when he was writing The Martian, or he'd written The Martian, it was being made into a film, and he was saying that he would spend 2 days on some maths and realised that it was one sentence in the book. But that set, you know, when you're reading The Martian, when you're reading Artemis, it's a similar kind of thing. You just, you get the joy that he's got, that he's put into it, comes out in your experience of reading it. It's a similar thing with the amount of effort that you put into these, as you say, small bits of the film, but I say integral bits of the film. It comes across, and it's, as Steve's saying, you go and watch the film again, because you want to get into that world, you want to be there and see those things.
Absolutely, it's those little details that create those layers of depth that ultimately like make the film much more. I don't know if believable is the right word, but you know, substantial and wonderful. You can lose yourself in it, because even though it's such a fantastical story, you can lose yourself in it because there's. You know, it feels grounded in reality. I mean, that was for many reasons, because of the design and the story and the rest of it. Yeah. But
I feel like we should probably let you go, because it's getting late. What did you do on The Martian?
Guess what? UI. We did the whole. We did the whole UI for basically everything that you see in the film, and when you said that anyway, it worked on. I done 2 days on a sentence in a film. I could show you some stuff that I worked on 2 weeks, and it ended up being like 25 frames. Well, that was quite important.
I have a question that probably won't make it into the podcast. All right. About The Martian.
Okay.
There's a very brief thing in the book that doesn't make it into the film. In the UI that NASA's watching when Watney's communicating with them over text.
Yeah.
They mention that it's being broadcast to the world. And in the book, he sends an open bracket, full stop, Y, full stop, close bracket.
Yeah.
And says, hair boobs. Did you make that and it got cut from the film, or did they decide that it wasn't going to be in the film in the first place?
I don't know. I'm definitely edging closer to NDA territory, but I don't remember working on anything like that. Just put it this way.
Okay, fair play.
Okay, speaking of NDAs, what are you working on now?
I think you can probably tell.
Yeah,
we can tell.
Yeah. Well, we've just about wrapped on Ready Player One.
Oh!
Yeah, that was.
We're a little bit excited about that.
Yep. How does it look?
It looks pretty incredible, actually. Not our stuff. I mean, it looks okay.
You should see a close up of Andrew's face. He's like 10 years older.
I'm broken and battered after 10 months. Yeah.
Cracking.
I'm so delighted that. that you guys are working on Ready Player One, because that book is amazing. Those things just speak to me so much. Mm. And to know that you guys have had a hand in it tells me that it's being looked after properly.
Well, it, do you want to come back in a few months' time?
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I think we can. I mean, it's you know, it seems like it's going to get mixed reviews.
So do Blade Runner.
Yeah, I mean, everything I'm reading, some people are quite, I don't know, sort of slightly perplexed by it, or kind of anti the whole kind of 80s reference culture and what have you. I just think it's a bit of fun. I think, yeah.
We're staying well away from spoilers at the moment, so we'll let you know what we think once we've watched it.
Well, there'll be a new, there's a new trailer coming out around Christmas.
Cool. I predict that the new Blade Runner is going to age as well as the old Blade Runner, which is a cult classic. It did similarly at the box office to the new Blade Runner, and over time I think it's stayed as good as it was when it was released. So thank you.
Yeah, totally. You're very welcome. I can't wait to show it to my kids when they are a little bit older.
Yeah.
Because I think I would probably have to do a bit of explanation here and there. Yeah. But
totally. Listen, thanks so much for talking to us, and we're going to get you back for Ready Player One. So
that sounds cool.
Brilliant.
Good stuff. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much, guys, for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
And thank you to Matty and Steve for joining me here in the Cosmic Shed.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew.
And thank you for listening. Goodbye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.